KBOO is currently running a Kickstarter campaign to build a city of media makers. From February 8th to March 9th, you can become a media maker and help spread the word. Just go to kboo.fm/Kickstarter between now and March 9th to join.
They found that during the years that Cyril Ramaphosa was the chairperson of the MTN board, MTN had been shifting billions in profit from the continent to outside. And then we saw much more recently in the Paradise Papers leak that Shanduka, a company which Cyril Ramaphosa founded in 2001...
Coquetto, we just have 10 seconds.
...as shifting profits from the country. So there is a pattern of behavior.
So are you concerned about what this means for South Africa in our last 5 seconds?
Completely. I think we should be deeply concerned, and we should be just as vigilant as we were in the times that we had President Jacob Zuma, if not more so. The moment that we in after Zuma has stepped down should not see civic movement.
Coquetto Moete, I want to thank you for being with us, founder of Amandla Mobi. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
KBOO is building a city of media makers. We believe that strong, resilient communities know how to make their own media. For 50 years, KBOO has trained thousands of people how to make radio. And we know that with our expertise and your support, we can keep the city activated and aware through radio we make together. Invest in future media makers and join us on Kickstarter today.
Join us on Kickstarter today. Go to kboo.fm/Kickstarter. Donate to the campaign and share it with your friends. And thank you for your support of KBOO.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certifications requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The events committee meets the third Thursday of each month at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
No classrooms, no teachers, no students at KBOO. Only community members sharing their skills with one another and passing on what they've learned from another DJ to the next generation of programmers. We believe that all have something to teach and we all have something to learn. Knowledge should be free to access. Your support for KBOO ensures this. Help us build a city of artistic media makers. Long live DIY Radio and join us on Kickstarter today.
Go to kboo.fm/Kickstarter. Donate to the campaign and share it with your friends. And thank you for your support of KBOO.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 5:02. Coming up next is your Friday evening news.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, we'll hear from City Hall, where the council received a report on police shootings yesterday.
An Indigenous roller derby team made its debut in London.
And a report from the Southern Poverty Law Center details killings by the so-called alt-right.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, February 16th, 2018. I'm Linda Olson Osterlund.
And I'm Ruben Lawrence. The Portland Police Bureau is requesting community feedback on 4 important directives that cover protests, cop watching, tracking officer performance, and training. In total, there are over 100 directives in the Portland Police Manual covering everything from breast milk expression to use of deadly force, Periodically, the Bureau submits batches of directives for public comment, which is collected online. The directives currently up for their first universal review are those dealing with crowd management and crowd control, community member observation of police, and the employee information system. A fourth directive dealing with training is up for its second review. Comments can be posted until March 17th for the first review and March 2nd for the second review. The directives can be found at the Portland Police website at www.portlandoregon.gov/police. KABU will have more on these directives and their significance to the community in the coming weeks.
The Southern Poverty Law Center released an article recently that counted over 100 people being murdered or injured by alleged perpetrators influenced by the so-called alt-right, a multifaceted movement that is continuing to access the mainstream through young recruits. The article was not based on a full study and was published before the devastating Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School gun massacre that took place on Wednesday. 19-year-old Nicholas Cruz, the gunman in the massacre Wednesday, showed a digital footprint that revealed ties to white supremacists. He's since admitted to the shootings. The SPLC's article pointed out that the rise in fatalities being committed by young white men in their teens and early 20s was particularly violent in the year 2017, with 9 of the 12 incidents cited taking place in that year alone. The article listed 13 alt-right related fatal episodes, leaving 43 dead and more than 60 injured. All perpetrators except one were white in the report and either claimed to have been or were revealed to have been, had ties with the alternative right, a term coined in part by white nationalist leader Richard Bertrand Spencer in 2008. Formally tracking hate crimes and injuries is a relatively new branch of data gathering within organizations and news sources. The Southern Poverty Law Center releases its own more complete report on the United States hate groups annually each year in February.
A roller derby team called Team Indigenous made their debut as a team at the recent Roller Derby World Cup in London. Representing 20 different Indigenous nations from all over the world, Team Indigenous strives to highlight the resiliency of Indigenous athletes. Before one of their final matches, Team Indigenous took the opportunity to bring awareness to the issue of missing and murdered Indigenous women around the world. Team Indigenous invited all the Indigenous athletes participating in the World Cup to join them on the track while they held flags, wore regalia, and read their mission statement. Laura Martinez, co-captain of Team Indigenous, describes the powerful moment.
So we got all the Indigenous people we could to come out on the track with us, and we wore our regalia, and we held our flags, and Nick read our mission statement, and statistics about missing and murdered Indigenous women, and about, you know, the fact that these pipelines and fracking and all of this is the modern-day manifest destiny of Indigenous people, and a lot of these women who go missing and murdered are as a result of that are at these locations where they're drilling and fracking and laying pipelines. These men are coming from these camps and abducting women. And, you know, we felt it was very important as a team to highlight the fact that this is something that's happening today in our world. And Mick asked everybody to stand with us and have a minute of silence. And it was really, like, I'm still getting emotional even, like, talking about it. Like, it was really moving to see this entire crowd of people and fans all the way up on either side standing up with us and standing in silence with us. And then after the minute of silence, the announcer said, you know, thank you, everyone, or something. And just the uproarious cheer that we got from everybody was so amazing and so powerful. And it was really such an incredible experience, because for me and for a lot of us on Team Indigenous, being Indigenous is a huge part of our lives, but roller derby is also a huge part of our lives. And being able to bring those two together in that way, and to an audience thousands of people, not only at the venue, but who were watching on the live stream, to be able to see us, see our presence, and hear our message was just so amazing and powerful and moving for me and for the rest of the team, as well as spectators. You know, spectators came to me afterward and were like, even a referee came to me afterward and told me how moving and emotional and amazing that was for him to witness.
That was Laura Martinez, roller derby co-captain of Team Indigenous, speaking about her team's participation at this year's Roller Derby World Cup in London, where they highlighted the worldwide problem of missing and murdered Indigenous women.
Yesterday, Portland City Council heard a presentation on a new report into police shootings. KBOO reporter Sam Bowman was there and had the story.
Yesterday, Portland City Council, well, three-fifths of the council, was present. Yesterday, Portland City Council, well, three-fifths of the council, was presented with a report on six police shootings. The report was investigated and written by the OIR group out of Los Angeles and included recommendations for increased accountability. It is the sixth report the OIR group has submitted to the city at the request of the city auditor, the first being specifically focused on the in-custody death of James Chassie. After that report, the group was tapped to write a series of reports systematically examining officer-involved shootings in Portland. So far, they've examined 41. Group member Julie Rulin here explains to the council the scope of the current report, which can be viewed on the Independent Police Review website.
This report, we talk about six officer-involved shootings. Two of those were fatal shootings. Three of them resulted in injuries to the person being shot at, and one of them was a non-hit shooting that nonetheless received the same level of scrutiny from the Bureau and the same level of review from us.
One thing the council did not hear yesterday was public testimony. Dan Handelman of Portland Cop Watch told me before the session that the city council heard testimony after each of the previous reports were presented, taking issue with the mayor's rationale for disallowing public testimony this time. A sign outside council chambers referred to a section of Portland City Code for the reasoning behind not allowing testimony. Handelman took issue with this, including during a testy exchange with Mayor Wheeler before the meeting began, pointing out that the relevant section of City Code actually reads that during a report presentation, quote, "The presiding officer shall determine whether public testimony shall be received and the amount of time which shall be allotted to each person," end quote. Wheeler, the presiding officer, did not offer much in the way of explanation for his choice and remained firm as the session began. He also issued his now common admonition that anyone acting disruptive would be subject to arrest and removal. On a somewhat unrelated note, there were about eight police officers in the audience, fully armed, despite being there for the purpose of answering the council's questions on the report. They included Chief Danielle Outlaw, Internal Affairs Captain Jeff Bell, and Training Division Commander Bob Day, among other ranking officers. The police nearly outnumbered community members. The session was sparsely attended overall, with perhaps 30 people in the room, most of them city employees. Two representatives of the OIR group were in attendance, Michael Giannacco and Julie Rulin. Cable reporter Jasmine Moneymaker spoke with Giannacco on Tuesday, an interview available in abridged form at kboo.fm. Yesterday, Giannacco laid out the ideal scope and goals of an investigation into a use of deadly force.
One, and this is a district attorney responsibility eventually, but to determine whether or not the actions of the officers run afoul of state law with regard to use of force, but also to evaluate the incident to determine whether or not the incident is consistent with the expectations of the police agency itself, is consistent with the directives of that police agency, is consistent with the way in which the officer who uses deadly force has been trained, and also whether the act itself and all the events leading up to the act and subsequent to the incident are carefully reviewed to determine, one, what happened, two, is there a way we can do better, with the idea that that kind of holistic review, introspection, reflection, and identification of remedial measures, including accountability, training, policy development, can help lessen the likelihood that a similar deadly force incident will occur. Will we get to zero? I think that is ultimately the goal of getting to zero. Will it happen overnight? No. But we can say that, in our estimation, as reflected in this report and in our past reports, of the 41 shootings we have reviewed in the course of our responsibilities here, that there has been a trend line that has been optimistic.
The report ends with 26 recommendations for the Bureau to improve its investigations, as well as a response from Chief Outlaw agreeing with all of them. This is a first, at least for OIR's reports. The previous five reports, including that on the Chassis case, saw former Chief Reese disagreeing with a few recommendations at least. Two of the reports lack itemized responses from the Bureau entirely. It remains to be seen how committed the Chief and her command staff are to implementing these recommendations, though they made a good show of it yesterday.
We are sincerely trying to not only build bridges, but to enhance our transparency and to show that we truly are genuine and that we want to get it right.
Probably the most well-known adopted recommendation of the OIR group was that the city scrap the 48-hour rule, which prevented investigators from interviewing an officer involved in a shooting for 48 hours after the incident. The rule was scrapped in late 2016 during collective bargaining with the Portland Police Association, and again early last year after it was discovered that a loophole extended this no-interview period, potentially by months. As I said earlier, no public testimony was allowed at the session, though Commissioner Fish and Mayor Wheeler did ask some questions of their own to the OIR group, Chief Outlaw, and Captain Bell, as well as some questions submitted by citizens, such as the League of Women Voters. The only other commissioner present, Chloe Udaly, remained silent. Commissioners Saltzman and Fritz were absent, meaning there was no quorum to vote on whether or not to override Wheeler and allow public comment. On that note, Michael Giannacco of the OIR group wrapped up his testimony with a nod to citizen input.
And something that we absolutely benefit from when we come up to visit you all is our ability to interface with your community. Because while the community may not be experts, some are becoming experts on police practices, they certainly provide an important perspective and give us a better and general and broader understanding of the concerns of your community. And that dialogue that we're able to have only makes our report, I think, more informed. So we appreciate their work and their willingness to meet with us on a regular basis.
I was able to speak with a few of the folks who showed up having prepared testimony to read. Two of them were Kalei and Ted Leuben, citizen activists present at many of these hearings, and asked what they would have said given the chance.
My interest is really in having people learn. That's what's big, the learning process. And human beings learn from human beings, not from statistics and not from dehumanization. So the real implication then for me is if the police officers do not receive procedural justice within the Bureau, they're never going to extend it to us in the community. And we know we desperately need that. So I'd like to just simply share the concept of procedural justice all across the board. Everybody. Police, community, all of us.
The next OIR report on Portland police uses of deadly force is expected in August. For KABU Community Radio in Portland, I'm Sam Bowman.
You are listening to the KABU Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin. At 6, it's Bread and Roses. That's followed at 7 by Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's weather will be a low of 45 with an 80% chance of rain. Today in history, the Lebanese Shia-based militant political party Hezbollah was founded. It already existed unofficially since the Israeli invasion of Lebanon in 1982, when Iran began funneling money and arms to Shia resistance fighters in the south of the country. The quote of the day is from Harry Potter author J.K. Rowling, who said, "It's our choices that show who we really are, far more than our abilities."
Tuesday's shooting at a public high school in Parkland, Florida, was the 18th school shooting in the first 30 school days of 2018. KBOO's Ray Bodwell has these thoughts into the latest horrific assault on America's children.
In the immediate aftermath of Wednesday's school shooting in Florida, Donald Trump's first comments came via Twitter. He focused on the mental health of the shooter with a tweet that said, quote, "Neighbors and classmates knew he was a big problem. Must always report such instances to authorities again and again," end quote. As it turns out, many people, authorities included, were well aware that Nicholas Cruz was a potential catastrophe waiting to happen. Concerned about his behavior, his mother had called the police on several occasions and asked them to try to talk some sense into him. While still a student at Stoneman Douglas High School, administrators and teachers apparently shared their concerns and sent warnings to each other via email. He was not allowed on school grounds with a backpack. Ultimately, his behavior resulted in his expulsion from school. Classmates were said to have referred to him as someone most likely to come back and shoot up the school. One concerned individual even contacted the FBI last year after seeing a YouTube video where Cruz allegedly said, "I'm going to be a professional school shooter," end quote. But despite all the red flags, there was no process to ensure that Nicholas Cruz got the mental health assistance that he so obviously needed, and he could still legally buy a gun and multiple high-capacity magazines. And so, once again, another alienated young man with easy access to firearms has destroyed lives, torn apart families, and left a community in tears. In 1980, President Jimmy Carter signed the landmark Mental Health Systems Act, which provided grants to community mental health centers. That law was repealed under the Omnibus Budget Reconciliation Act of 1981, signed by Ronald Reagan. Yesterday, during a brief speech in response to the shooting, President Trump spoke directly to America's children.
"You have people who care about you, who love you, and who will do anything at all to protect you. If you need help, turn to a teacher, a family member, a local police officer, or a faith leader."
You'll note that he did not include community mental health centers as a place to turn for help because most communities don't have them. He then went on to make this cruelly ironic statement.
"We are committed to working with state and local leaders to help secure our schools and tackle the difficult issue of mental health."
Does he really think that we're going to forget that almost exactly 1 year ago, he signed the bill that revoked Obama-era gun checks for people with mental illness? Which brings us around to the other required component of school shootings, the guns themselves. He never mentioned them, but he did make one remark that I'm sure that all Americans would agree on.
"No child, no teacher should ever be in danger in an American school."
But as a candidate, Trump was a darling of the National Rifle Association, and as president, he and the Republican majority have assisted the gun lobby in rolling back existing restrictions and blocking consideration of many sensible new restrictions at every turn. Americans are 20 times more likely to die from gun violence than citizens of other developed nations. So far, in the first 30 school days of 2018, there have been 18 shootings in American schools. But I'm afraid that until America's school children are able to hire lobbyists and distribute campaign donations as readily as the National Rifle Association, they will continue to be at the mercy of any madman with easy access to firearms. For KBOO, this is Ray Bodwell.
And now it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Native American news, issues, and culture from Native Voice One. Find more stories and podcasts at nv1.org.
With National Native News, I'm Art Hughes, in for Antonia Gonzalez. The National Congress of American Indians wrapped up its Executive Council winter session in Washington, D.C., but before doing so, the group's leaders expressed their concerns about the federal budget proposed by President Trump. NCAI issued a written press release saying, if enacted, the budget would represent a clear retreat from the federal commitments and treaty promises made to tribes. The press release said the statement reflects the unified opposition by 500 tribal representatives against the proposed fiscal year 2019 budget. Among the concerns is what it says is a $500 million cut from the Bureau of Indian Affairs, a cut of nearly a third to BIA social services, and a 25% cut to Indian child welfare, in addition to other significant funding losses that affect Indian country. In a speech to the Assembly this week, NCAI Vice President Aaron Payment calls the budget the worst Indian country has seen. NCAI officials urge Congress to uphold the U.S. government's trust responsibility. One of the more notable events at the NCAI session was Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren's speech, in which she acknowledged she is not an enrolled member of any tribe. But nonetheless, Warren again claimed her mother's family was, in her words, part Native American, and she is adhering to what she says is her family's story from her parents who were married 63 years.
They're gone, but the love they shared, the struggles they endured, the family they built, and the story they lived will always be a part of me, and no one, not even the President of the United States, will take that part of me away. Not ever.
Cherokee activist Rebecca Nagel told The Intercept that Warren's speech is a step in the right direction. Nagel said she appreciated Warren's focus on underlying issues important to Native people rather than herself. Nagel previously criticized Warren in an op-ed for the website Think Progress, saying Warren is, quote, not from us and she does not represent us. Warren devoted part of her speech to relaying the history of Pocahontas, a move brought on by President Trump's repeated derisive nickname for Warren because of her previous claims of Native heritage. Warren promised to highlight important Native issues every time the president insisted on repeating the insult. An executive at the Southwestern Indian Polytechnic Institute in Albuquerque remains on paid leave while the Department of Interior investigates allegations of sexual harassment and even assault. The independent online news source Government Executive first reported the allegations against Vice President for College Operations, Eric Christensen. SIPI is run by Interior's Bureau of Indian Education. The reporter talked to numerous staff members who relayed incidences of intimidation, harassment, sexual advances, and retaliation. One employee leveled a criminal charge against Christensen, which the article says police declined to pursue. Family and friends are mourning the death this week of Michael Smith, the founder and director of the American Indian Film Institute. A GoFundMe page to raise money for funeral expenses says Smith died unexpectedly Wednesday from complications of the heart. The site lists his age as 66. Smith was a member of the Fort Peck Sioux tribe. He was instrumental in putting on the first American Indian Film Festival in Seattle in 1975. The event later moved to San Francisco and led to the formation of the Institute. Noted broadcaster and film producer Frank Blythe told KGUA's Peggy Berryhill that Smith leaves a remarkable legacy.
He just loved Indian film. He was a good promoter of it. And he really worked hard at providing the best film festival as he could get together. And it was, and always has been, the major Indian film festival event of the year.
Smith's surviving family includes his wife, two children, and a granddaughter. With National Native News, I'm Art Hughes.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Ray Bodwell, Jasmine Moneymaker, and Jenna Yokoyama. The producer is Sam Bowman. Our engineer is Jenna Yokoyama. And the KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Zello Celos Marchant. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/evening news. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Linda Olson Osterlund.
And I'm Reuben Lawrence. Coming up this morning on KBOO, coming up on Monday morning on KBOO. At 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 on More Talk Radio, Cecil and Celeste welcome writer and filmmaker David Walker to talk about the Portland Black Film Festival. At 9, the Old Mole Variety Hour burrows down to the roots of the great issues of our time. At 10 on Locus Focus, Barbara Bernstein's show about our place on the planet. At 11, Making Contact studies law enforcement history as a tool of social control and asks if it's time to consider the end of policing. KBOO's Kickstarter is live. Go to kboo.fm/Kickstarter and help KBOO build a city of media makers. That's kboo.fm/Kickstarter. Thanks for listening and have a good evening. Good night, Linda.
Good night, Reuben. Good night, Jenna.
Good night, everybody.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, what do you do with a press corps that pauses from raising alarms about North Korea's warmongering to raise alarms about North Korea's peacemongering? Signs of rapprochement between North and South Korea at the Pyongyang Olympics have led to media accounts warning Americans not to fall for peace offensive propaganda. But we are in favor of lowering tensions on the Korean Peninsula, right? Right. We'll talk about the prospects for war and for peace with North Korea with Christine Hall.